Good evening, I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. On the NewsHour tonight, fierce fighting continues in southern Gaza's largest city as hospital conditions become increasingly dire for the civilians caught in the crossfire.
Congress struggles to reach an agreement to fund Israel, Ukraine, and the southern border before lawmakers head home for the holidays.
And Judy Woodruff explores how the COVID pandemic has made it harder for Americans to separate politics from public health.
It's going to be much tougher now to convince Americans to take vaccines because of the damage done from this predatory anti-vaccine campaign.
Welcome to the NewsHour. Israel intensified its military operations in Gaza's second largest city today, forcing tens of thousands of Palestinians to flee and making it more difficult to deliver aid.
The United Nations says nearly 1.9 million people, or over 80% of Gaza's population, have been displaced by the war, many several times over. They're now crowded into small areas in south and central Gaza, with the humanitarian situation worsening by the day.
Southern Gaza is now the center of the war, and once again, civilians bear the brunt, caught between Hamas hiding among them and Israel's bombardment. In Khan Yunis overnight, Amal Mehdi and her two children were jolted awake by an Israeli airstrike. Sifting through the wreckage, she says they're lucky to be alive.
We were peacefully sleeping, not bothering anyone, asleep, and I have young children, minding our own business. All of a sudden, the bombardment hit us. It was a miracle that we were pulled from under the rubble.
Israel says its troops have fully breached Khan Yunis in what they call a third phase of ground operations, surrounding the house of Gaza's Hamas leader, Yahya Sinwar. And the Israel Defense Forces released this rare image of 11 Hamas military commanders, five of whom the IDF says have been killed. But fighting continues in the north. Officials today claimed they discovered the largest weapons cache yet near a school in Gaza City. Palestinians, meanwhile, are being pushed into rapidly shrinking spaces. Mohammed Hamel fled his home in the north.
They told us to go to the south because it is safe. Nothing will happen to you there. No place is safe in Gaza.
In the overcrowded Nasser Hospital, 11-year-old Saba Magnum, with an injured arm, frantically searches for her father. Her younger siblings collapse into tears when he's found. They're told that he's just injured his leg, but they cling to their father, injured in an airstrike at a Khan Yunis school.
We were at the school. They hit us twice. It landed on us and on my father. Then they all got injured.
5-year-old Amir was there.
I went into the classroom and went to play with my friend. Then suddenly I heard a sound going boom and we ran. Father, a big rock fell on father, hit him here, and a big rock fell on me here.
Hospitals elsewhere have become funeral grounds. Mourners gathered outside this facility in Deir al-Balah, reciting prayers beside dozens of bodies lining the street. According to Doctors Without Borders, hospitals are running critically low on fuel and medical supplies, with some 200 wounded brought in every day. At the nearby UN distribution center, crowds desperate for food waited hours for a small portion of flour. Om Hussein says she's risking her life to provide for her family.
The way they are gathering here, if there was bombing right now, how many martyrs would we have? There should be food distribution centers in every area. I didn't get anything. Where am I supposed to go?
There is a heightened risk of atrocity crimes.
In Geneva today, the UN's human rights chief, Volker Türk, described the situation in Gaza as apocalyptic.
Some 1.9 million out of the 2.2 million Palestinians have been displaced and are being pushed into ever diminishing and extremely overcrowded places in southern Gaza in unsanitary and unhealthy conditions. And humanitarian aid is again virtually cut off as fears of widespread disease and hunger spread.
Meanwhile, the future of post-war Gaza remains uncertain. After a report that Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas said he would be willing to assume governance, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu posted, quote, "Those who educate their children for terrorism, finance terrorism, and support terrorist families will not be able to rule Gaza after eliminating Hamas." Whatever happens next, Gazans like Mai Salim are determined to stay there. Sheltering in a tent city less than a mile from the Egyptian border, she says she'd rather die than move any further.
For us, this is the last stop. After that, if they want to forcibly displace us, we will not leave. They can kill us right here, but we will not leave our land and our entire lives. We will not do that.
In the day's other headlines, a gunman opened fire at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and the sheriff there said at least three people were shot. There was no immediate word on their conditions. Police and rescue units swarmed the campus as the university reported shootings in at least two buildings. The gunman died after being confronted by officers, but the circumstances were unclear. President Biden urged Congress today to approve billions of dollars in new military and economic aid to Ukraine. The White House says the money will run out at year's end without congressional action. The president said that would be a gift to Russian President Vladimir Putin and that he would not stop with Ukraine.
If he keeps going and then he attacks a NATO ally, where we've committed as a NATO member that we defend every inch of NATO territory, then we'll have something that we don't seek and that we don't have today, American troops fighting Russian troops.
Later, Senate Republicans blocked debate on the aid measure unless it includes new action to tighten the U.S. southern border. President Biden says he's willing to make significant changes on border policy, but he gave no details. In Ukraine, President Volodymyr Zelensky said today his government will boost its own military production and defeat Russia against all odds. The U.S. Justice Department today charged four Russians with war crimes against an American living in Ukraine. They're accused of kidnapping the man from the village where he lived with his Ukrainian wife in the spring of 2022. Then they allegedly tortured him for 10 days. The charges are largely symbolic since the four defendants are not in U.S. custody. Republicans are holding their fourth presidential debate tonight, this time at the University of Alabama. Once again, former President Donald Trump is not taking part. Instead, he appeared last night with Fox host Sean Hannity, and he would not rule out abusing power if he's reelected.
He says, "You're not going to be a dictator, are you?" I said, "No, no, no, other than day one. We're closing the border, and we're drilling, drilling, drilling."
Meantime, President Biden had suggested Tuesday that he might not be running again if Mr. Trump were not running. Today, he said there might be 50 Democrats who could win that race, but he vowed, quote, "I will defeat him." Former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy is leaving Congress by the end of the year. The California Republican announced it today in the Wall Street Journal. He said, quote, "I have decided to depart the House to serve America in new ways." Hard-right conservatives engineered McCarthy's ouster back in October. He's the first speaker to be voted out of the job. There's new evidence that 2023 is set to be the warmest year on record. European Union scientists report that November was the sixth month in a row to break heat marks. That news came today as the UN's COP28 climate summit wrapped up its first week of meetings in Dubai, amid debate over phasing out fossil fuels. The EU's climate commissioner appealed for bolder action.
And the science is crystal clear. I've repeatedly said it, and I'm going to repeat it here. We have no alternative than to follow what scientists tell us. And they're telling us we're simply not on track. I want this COP to mark the beginning of the end for fossil fuels.
The climate summit continues through Tuesday. Here at home, some of the country's biggest banks appealed to U.S. senators today to head off new regulations. The Biden administration's proposals would force the firms to keep more capital on hand. But CEOs of seven major banks argued it would curtail lending and hurt profits. They also condemned efforts to limit overdraft fees.
It makes no sense. I mean, that's the bottom line. I've been at this for a long time. I served on the New York Fed board for years. I've seen a lot of rules. Some of them make sense, and it's a question of how far you turn the dial. This doesn't make sense.
The banks say they need flexibility in the face of inflation and higher interest rates. Regulators say this year's bank failures call for tougher rules. And on Wall Street, falling oil prices helped drag stocks lower. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 70 points to close at 36,054. The NASDAQ fell 83 points. The S&P 500 slipped 17. And still to come on the NewsHour, the 25th anniversary of the International Space Station highlights its scientific and cultural impact. Author Tim Alberta discusses his new book about American evangelicals in an age of political extremism. And we reflect on the life of legendary TV producer and writer Norman Lear.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Days of tension on Capitol Hill culminated today in Republicans rejecting a measure to move ahead on additional funding for Ukraine and Israel. Republicans have been insisting that foreign aid be paired with major changes to border security, but both sides of the aisle failed to find consensus, and now billions of dollars in aid is stalled until lawmakers find a way forward. In the middle of all this is Majority Whip and Senator from Illinois, Dick Durbin, who joins us now. Senator Durbin, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
So what does today's vote mean? There's no aid for Ukraine this year, then?
It's a setback, but it doesn't mean that we're not going to send aid to Ukraine. The Speaker of the Parliament of Ukraine was in my office today. He told me what is obvious. If we don't provide assistance to Ukraine, their likelihood of winning the war against Putin is diminished dramatically. And every single day, courageous Ukrainians are giving their lives to defend their country against this war criminal from Moscow. It really means that we can't fail to provide the assistance Ukraine needs. We've got to stand with them, and we've got to do it before the end of the year.
So how do you do that before the end of the year, Senator? We heard President Biden say earlier he's open to significant changes on border policy. Do you share that view?
Yes, I do. Let's be open-minded about it. I don't want to do something that is inconsistent with our country's values, but I recognize the obvious. We are being overwhelmed at our border by people seeking to come into the United States. We have got to adjust the standards that are used at the border in a reasonable, humane way, but we've got to be open to change, Democrats as well as Republicans.
So what are some of those changes you'd be willing to compromise on that you weren't before? Would they be tightening asylum rules, for example?
Well, I take a look at the asylum language standards, but I'd be very careful because there are people who are genuinely escaping situations where their lives are in danger, and we don't want to ignore that possibility. But I also want to make sure that we have a system that makes sense. If I told you the countries that are producing immigrants at our border and south of the United States, you'd be amazed. Thousands coming from places like Uzbekistan. You think to yourself, that is not what I expect to hear. What is happening is an obvious move from around the world to use the United States as a refuge.
Senator, we should acknowledge there seems to be a big crowd behind you there. We're hearing some applause. Thank you for bearing with us. I hope you can hear us. But I should ask you, too, as part of those talks, what about the Dreamers, those DACA recipients who were brought to the U.S. as children? You've said that you will fight for them repeatedly, but they were not included in these last rounds of talks. What's your message to them today?
Well, I can just tell you, I think that's a serious mistake. I've been fighting for these Dreamers for over 20 years since I introduced the legislation. These young people, 800,000 of them or more, should be part of America's future. And we have to do everything we can to make that happen. If I get a chance to be part of this immigration negotiation, and I hope I will definitely include that request.
I want to ask you, too, about the aid to Israel. A significant portion of the emergency aid requested by the Biden administration is for that security assistance. As you well know, since that brutal October 7th attack, Israel's response has killed more than 15,000 Palestinians. The majority are believed to be women and children. And your colleague Bernie Sanders is now saying it's absolutely irresponsible to give Israel unconditional aid. Do you believe that aid should be conditioned if it means it could save Palestinian lives?
Yes, we should have basic conditions that if we're going to provide military assistance to any nation, the United States should make it clear what the standards of conduct are that we expect. And in the situation in Israel, there's no question they have a right to defend themselves, and what happened on October 7th was an atrocity. But we also are staring at a humanitarian crisis of epic proportions currently in that area, with the Palestinian people losing thousands and thousands of their own. 70% of the victims were women and children, an unheard of number. So we've got to say to the Israelis, yes, defend yourself. Yes, make sure your country is safe, but do it in a humane fashion.
So what does a basic condition look like to you?
The basic condition would just establish standards for every country that receives military equipment from the United States, that they make sure that they don't focus on civilian casualties, but only military targets, that they are careful in the proportionality that they use in using bombs of certain size, for example, and that there be a serious effort to take precautions to protect the innocent people in that country. These are the standards of humane conduct in war. We should expect nothing less.
Senator, I have to ask you, our colleague Lisa Desjardins, who I know you know, has been reporting on what we've seen on Capitol Hill this week. Yesterday, we saw senators yelling during a briefing with administration officials, several Republican senators walking out. Emotions around the war are certainly high. We know immigration is a white-hot issue. And we've just learned, of course, former Speaker Kevin McCarthy is retiring at the end of the year. I just want to ask you, the climate on Capitol Hill right now, have you ever seen anything like this?
No, I haven't. And I'll just tell you that it's attributable to one man's politics, which unfortunately has created a situation I've never seen before in all the time that I've served in Congress. But there are still people of goodwill trying to solve real problems facing America and our friends. I just want to add that was a terrible meeting we had yesterday. We had a much better meeting today. I'm hopeful that despite the gloomy scenario we seem to face, we can still find a way to help the Ukrainians and come out with a good result for the American people.
So do you believe there will be a deal to move that forward, to move the aid for Ukraine forward before you leave for Christmas?
Listen, I'm an optimist. I wouldn't be in politics if I weren't. And I believe that if we work at it before the end of the year, we can do the right thing.
Senator Dick Durbin joining us tonight from Capitol Hill. Senator, thank you. Always good to see you.
Thanks, Amna.
This week marks the 25th anniversary of when astronauts first stepped onto the beginnings of a new international space station. A quarter of a century later, the station is now manned by 7 international crew members and has become an iconic and important part of space history. It circles the globe almost every 90 minutes. But the celebration is bittersweet, as the station is set to be decommissioned. I spoke earlier about it with our science correspondent, Miles O'Brien. Miles, thanks for joining us. What would you say are the main accomplishments of the International Space Station 25 years later?
I would say, Jeff, it is not so much the science as it is the partnership itself. The fact that the former Cold War space race rivals, the U.S. and Russia, got together in a partnership along with Europe, Japan, and Canada, about 15 nations in all, and managed to make this partnership work all this time is truly extraordinary, especially when you consider recent events in Ukraine and some concerns that the partnership would go sideways. And yet, at the cosmonaut level, the engineer level, there are healthy and safe relationships, most importantly for the International Space Station, which have endured. And there's a lesson in there somewhere. The fact that a peacetime project like this involving multiple nations could last so long. I can't think of anything quite like it.
Well, beyond the important relationships and the diplomacy, what can you tell us about the science that has been conducted on board?
It's been interesting. Most of the science, frankly, is all about allowing humans and spacecraft to endure space for long periods of time. So it's narrowly focused in many respects on its own mission. However, there have been some spillovers into other areas, and NASA likes to tout the space station as a way of solving problems here on Earth. Just to give you an example, though, when you learn about osteoporosis on Earth, it has a lot to do with what astronauts encounter when they're in space. Their bones become brittle and become weaker, and as they return to Earth, they have a hard time rebuilding all of that. So they've learned about how to manage that by learning how to keep their astronauts safe in space. So there has been some science. The idea, though, that they would somehow go up there and grow these protein crystals in zero gravity in a way that you could identify new ways to make drugs and cure cancer, that has not happened, however.
Well, 25 years is an eternity when it comes to tech and innovation. And the ISS has these Russian modules on board, which I understand have had all sorts of technical issues, including some leaks. So when is the International Space Station slated for retirement?
Yes, Jeff, it's a little long in tooth at this point. Some of the Russian modules have been leaking, and there have been other problems along the way. It's getting old. Right now, NASA has committed to flying the station until 2030. The Russians say they want to get out a little bit sooner, but we are in the latter days of the space station era, at least the International Space Station era. Maybe others will follow.
Well, once the space station is gone, will there be destinations for NASA or other commercial spacecraft in low Earth orbit?
Well, it's a little bit like what happened after the shuttle. NASA turned to lean on private enterprise a little more, mostly with SpaceX. In this case, NASA is seeking commercial entities to build space stations that NASA could use as a destination and pay to visit. One of the companies, Axiom, based in Houston, which has a lot of old NASA space station players involved in it, actually has a docking port on the current International Space Station and aims to launch a module onto the space station to get it sort of up and running. And then when the space station goes off into the horizon, so to speak, or off into the west, they would undock and begin building this commercial station. The concern is there'll be some sort of gap once again, as there was after the shuttle retired before the U.S. was able to get astronauts in space from U.S. soil.
Do I have it right, Miles, that China will be the only nation to directly operate a space station by 2030? What kind of problems does that create?
It's interesting. You know, you think of the decision back in 2006, I believe it was, when Congress said NASA should not partner with the Chinese on the space station. The Chinese really wanted in. You've got to wonder if that was the best decision in retrospect. But yes, China has a space station now. It's been up and running, continuously manned now since 2021. The U.S. presumably will move into this commercial space station. Meanwhile, Vladimir Putin claims Russia will build another government-run space station that it hopes to have in orbit by 2027. Remains to be seen if that's going to be real. But regardless, I think, you know, it's important for NASA to have a destination in low Earth orbit that it can go to. If a commercial player will do it, that'd be great. I think it's a pretty difficult business case, however.
And my last question, Miles, is a fairly practical one. How will NASA ensure that this giant space station doesn't become dangerous space junk and re-enter the atmosphere in an uncontrolled manner?
Yes, this is the Skylab scenario. 1979, the first U.S. space station fell out of the sky in an uncontrolled manner because it was waiting for the space shuttle to come boost it, and it wasn't ready to do that. And so it came down. Most of it landed in the Indian Ocean. Parts of it landed over Western Australia. It was a very controversial thing and had a lot of people scared there for a little while. What they'll do in this case is build a giant space tug, maybe turning to SpaceX, we'll see, attach it to the space station so it can be thrust down in a controlled manner into the southern Pacific Ocean where no one gets hurt, hopefully.
Like a cosmic tow truck. Miles O'Brien, thanks so much.
Just over 15% of American adults have gotten the latest COVID booster. Demand for the vaccine has dropped sharply since it was first introduced at the height of the pandemic. That's partly because the government's response to COVID-19 has been so politically charged. Judy Woodruff spoke to public health experts about that government response. It's part of her ongoing series, America at a Crossroads.
In March of 2020, many Americans were united in their fear of the new unknown virus. As people grapple with the images of overwhelmed hospitals and death abroad and in the U.S.
Hopefully it won't be much longer.
We, the people, will not come back.
But public opinion quickly splintered as governors issued stay-at-home orders to slow the spread of the virus.
It should be a choice, not a mandate.
People took to the streets to protest the economic and social impact of business closures, school shutdowns, and mask mandates across the country.
This is a tool to keep us at home and on house arrest.
My business is being decimated as we speak.
The risk of spread in schools is low, and the harm that we are doing to our children is high.
Leaders, including then-President Trump, offered conflicting information, including recommendations on masking and other prevention methods.
The CDC is advising the use of non-medical cloth face covering as an additional voluntary public health measure. This is voluntary. I don't think I'm going to be doing it.
COVID has shaken our faith in the current medical system.
For Clara and Jay Bowes, the pandemic marked a turning point.
You know, we were in Nevada at that time. The kids are being forced to wear a mask for 8 hours a day. And I started looking at, you know, is there any science behind that?
They joined hundreds of thousands of other Americans who migrated to Florida during the pandemic, drawn by the sunny weather and the state's looser COVID restrictions. It was in sharp contrast to the pandemic tension among their extended family.
We, you know, haven't lost any relationships over it, but we've definitely had some tension.
The relationships were strong. My younger brother, for example, works for a big pharma company. Mm-hmm. He thinks I'm completely nuts, and he's my only younger brother. And we have spirited discussions one way or another, you know. But he has not changed my thinking, and I have not changed his.
It soon became difficult to separate the politics from medicine, according to Dr. Joshua Sharfstein of Johns Hopkins. He has worked with the state of Maryland on public health recommendations.
The pandemic was sort of like a match that lit that on fire, because it brought together people who didn't like masks and people who were upset about, you know, a particular action early in the pandemic.
And that had deadly consequences, according to Dr. Peter Hotez of Baylor College of Medicine. He researched the human cost of the resistance to masks and vaccines in his new book, The Deadly Rise of Anti-Science.
The big differential in deaths was very much on states where people widely accepted vaccines and states where people did not widely accept vaccines. Quince, my estimate is that 200,000 Americans needlessly perished because they refused COVID vaccines after vaccines were widely available.
A poll out this September showed 91% of Democratic voters had received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, compared with 66% of Republican voters. And Democrats were far more likely to get the latest booster. And multiple studies show more Republican strongholds that resisted public health measures and vaccinations fared worse in terms of infection and mortality rates.
Our big pharma overlords have decided that we need to get rid of these vaccines before they expire.
Why do we need an experimental, mandatory vaccine for a disease, by the way, which you have a 99.997% chance of surviving?
No forced COVID vaccines for adults or children.
Dr. Hotez points to sharpened rhetoric in the summer of 2021, shortly before the vaccines were approved for younger children, as a turning point.
If the vaccine is effective, there is no reason for people who have received the vaccine to wear masks or avoid physical contact. So maybe it doesn't work, and they're simply not telling you that.
It was an entire ecosystem of elected officials on the far right together with Fox News and other news outlets. It was a predatory, organized, and deliberate disinformation campaign that convinced Americans that the vaccines didn't work or weren't safe, and they believed it, and they paid for it with their lives.
I've had a lot of people ask questions about these new COVID mRNA.
Just 3 months ago, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and his Surgeon General Joseph LaDapo recommended against the booster for healthy people under age 65. Their guidance directly contradicts CDC recommendations, but didn't go far enough for Vic Mellor, a former Marine, businessman, and Trump supporter who financed the We the People clinic in Sarasota County. He is against any COVID vaccination. Mellor and his staff are leading the charge in what they call the medical freedom movement, skeptical of the medical establishment and their recommendations on COVID-19 prevention and treatment methods. They also promote non-traditional health care, including IV therapy and drugs like ivermectin, which is not approved to treat COVID.
all the research that's gone into the vaccines, you still believe that it's harmful?
Absolutely harmful, yes. I don't believe their research at all.
His skepticism goes beyond COVID. In the same building that houses the clinic, he set up a political operation, what he calls a guard the vote war room. He says it will help monitor potential election fraud in 2024.
But it's going to be a training program for law enforcement and poll workers and precinct workers to identify when something is, when a law is being broken.
Down the hall, a podcast studio for Michael Flynn, who denies the results of the 2020 election. He served as President Trump's national security advisor before facing various criminal charges, which Mr. Trump then pardoned him for. Mellor told me while there were no federal mandates requiring vaccination, he felt state mandates and unofficial mandates by employers or doctor's offices threaten people's freedom to make their own medical decisions.
The nurse was so caring.
Clara and Jay Bowes, like other patients we met here, say they felt a huge sense of relief when they found the clinic and the alternative it offers to the government's messaging.
We didn't feel like they had done enough testing in order to merit our faith in it.
None of the claims that were being made, the big ones, safe, effective, doesn't let you get COVID, you don't transmit if you get,
if you
get
you
the shot.
If you care about your mom,
you don't die if you get the
it.
Shot. Yeah, if you care about your mom. There's a lot of...
It seemed pretty manipulative. Like,
yeah.
The Boses reject public health guidance for themselves and their young children.
We did not get the COVID vaccine shots for our kids or for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And we had COVID, we had 2 days, 3 days of some coughing and like a flu.
Resting.
And that was it.
Their pediatrician at the We the People clinic, Dr. Renata Moon, shares their doubts about the vaccine.
I've supported traditional childhood vaccines for my whole career. But as time went on, I was crunching numbers just like everybody. And it became clear to me from the data that we had from our government, that this COVID infection really wasn't a threat to our nation's children in terms of fatalities.
Just under 1,900 children have died from COVID in the U.S. since the pandemic began. But for this mRNA vaccine, Dr. Moon says her greatest worry lies in what she called deadly side effects, including inflammation of the heart muscle or myocarditis. The Centers for Disease Control maintains it is a very rare occurrence, that in fact, cases occurring after vaccination have generally been less severe than myocarditis caused by a viral COVID infection. The CDC adds that it and the Food and Drug Administration will continue to monitor for and evaluate reports of myocarditis. But Dr. Moon says when she raised these concerns, she was fired from her job in Washington State, where she previously practiced.
The medical school that terminated my employment sent the message that if you dare question anything related to COVID, if you dare color outside the lines of what is allowed, what the main narrative is, then you will be punished, right? And this is a dangerous place for us to be right now in America, with this idea that we can't question anything and that our own physicians can't question what they're seeing right in front of their eyes.
Are there things that the government, that public health officials could have done differently that would have changed the outcome here?
One of the key things that can help people come together is transparency. Transparency about what's being considered and an open discussion of the pros and cons. And oftentimes, I think public health officials, and not just public health officials, but also elected officials, just announce things like, today, here's what we're gonna do. You know, if instead you say, here's what we're thinking, we could do this or we could do that, then people respond to that by appreciating the bind that government is in. You know, there's often no perfect answer. Personally, I think one misstep was not doing more proposing and listening before acting.
Dr. Joshua Sharfstein said that this initial lack of transparency and conflicting advice may have contributed to the skepticism of the vaccines. In a recent move toward greater transparency, an open difference of views has arisen among scientists over at what age otherwise healthy individuals need the latest COVID vaccine shot, with the CDC recommending it for everyone 6 months of age and up, while several European countries, the World Health Organization, and a prominent U.S. pediatrician say it's not necessary for young people. For his part, Dr. Peter Hotez worries that our experience with the COVID-19 pandemic and the ongoing questioning and even threatening of scientists and public health officials will thwart the U.S. response to the next health emergency.
I don't see things getting better anytime soon. And the evidence for that is if you look at the percentage of Americans who took the bivalent booster last September in 2022 and it was made available, only about 20% of eligible Americans took it. And in terms of this new annual immunization, you know, I took it and about six other people. But so I'm really concerned. We're going to start the next pandemic with two strikes. So I think it's going to be much tougher now to convince Americans to take vaccines because of the damage done from this predatory anti-vaccine campaign.
One more potential divide in an already divided nation. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Judy Woodruff in Baltimore, Maryland, and Sarasota County, Florida.
White evangelical voters helped Donald Trump win the White House in 2016 and largely stuck by him again in 2020. In his new book, Tim Alberta sought to find out why, when that support is largely inconsistent with basic Christian values. He approaches the topic as a journalist and as a practicing Christian. Tim's father was a pastor, and he says the evangelical church was his home, which offered an up-close look at the ways in which GOP politics are transforming and fracturing the evangelical church. The book is titled The Kingdom, the Power, and the Glory, American Evangelicals in an Age of Extremism. I asked Tim about a searing moment he describes when at his own father's funeral, a church elder admonished him for not fully embracing Donald Trump as God's chosen leader.
Well, I think just once I was able to process it, because it was a surreal moment, having just buried my father, you're in this state of mourning and of shock and not sure, is this even real? And then you're reading this, and I think what it revealed more than anything, Jeff, was this epiphany of, boy, if I, the son of the senior pastor who was here for 25 years leading this congregation, if I, who grew up here, these people have known me since I was 5 years old, if I could be treated this way, if I could be regarded as a member of the deep state, as an enemy of the church, as an apostate, if I could be treated that way, then how are we treating those outside the church? How are we engaging with the culture whom we are called as Christians to evangelize?
Well, what is it about Donald Trump that has completely transformed and reconditioned the white evangelical expectation of what a political leader should be? I will tell you in my own reporting, I've talked to evangelical Trump supporters who have compared him to consequential biblical figures like David, Cyrus, Solomon, to make the point that he is someone, in their view, who can affect God's will without having to manifest any Christian values whatsoever.
Yeah. Yeah, and I've heard the same. And, you know, it's interesting. Obviously, when Donald Trump first came along in 2015, launching his campaign for president, he was mocked widely by evangelicals when he made his famous 2 Corinthians gaffe when he was speaking at Liberty University at the beginning of 2016. It was pounced on by a lot of leading evangelicals who are now some of his staunchest allies. And you ask yourself, well, how did he go from being a figure of suspicion and an outsider and somebody who was almost a punchline to being a champion for these people? And I think much of the answer to that, Jeff, is rooted in what you were describing. You said white evangelical. And I think it's important to sort of hone in on this idea that for the white Christian in America, they are now losing status in ways that they've never seen before. That if you look just statistically and demographically, you know, 50 years ago during the heyday of the moral majority, this was fundamentally a different country then than it is today. We are looking at decades-long downward trajectories in terms of the white percentage of the country, the percentage of the country that identifies as Christian, that identifies as church-going, and there is a sense of impending doom for a lot of these people, that the government is coming for them, that Christianity is in the crosshairs, and that we need to fight back. And in some sense, it takes someone like Donald Trump, who's not a Christian, and because he's not a Christian, he's not beholden to Christian values, and therefore, it makes him almost this mercenary who's willing to fight on behalf of this beleaguered population who feels under siege, and they've turned to someone like Donald Trump to do the dirty work for them.
Is that where Christian nationalism comes in, this belief that America is somehow in a unique covenant with God? What do Christian nationalists want that is different from the George W. Bush era Christian engagement with politics?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think in many ways, Christian nationalism is revolving around this idea that the Christian nation that we inherited from the founders, that it was an explicitly Christian nation, not just a nation informed by Judeo-Christian principles and values, but explicitly formed to be a Christian nation, that has to be recovered, that it has to be restored. And we are talking in some sense here about the T word, theocracy. I mean, there are people in this movement, and I would add people who hold real power and influence in the Republican Party, people who are close to former President Donald Trump, who would certainly be advising him in a second term, who have no qualms talking about the idea of essentially demolishing the wall between church and state and attempting to if not introduce Christianity as state religion in a concrete, official, formal way, at the very least to promote Christianity as state religion in ways, you just heard Donald Trump a couple of weeks ago on the campaign trail say he's thinking about not letting any more non-Christian migrants into the country. No Jews, no Muslims, no Hindus, no atheists. If you're gonna come to the US now, you need to be a Christian. And that is, I think, very explicitly some of the ways in which these folks are thinking about how they recover the America that they once knew.
So when Donald Trump says he wouldn't be a dictator if reelected except for day one, what he said earlier this week in that televised town hall with Sean Hannity, what do his evangelical supporters hear?
It's another great question. I mean, and you're right, because there's a dog whistle there. I think what Trump is speaking to here is a persecution complex more than anything else. When he talks about how the Christian church is under siege and so is he, when he talks to these evangelical supporters of his and says, you know, really they, the deep state, the liberals, the secularists, they're coming after you, but first they have to get through me. And that's why I'm being charged with all these indictments. That's why they're trying to take me down, is so that they can get to you. So when he pitches himself as a strong man, as a would-be authoritarian, I think in many ways what these people hear is, well, desperate times call for desperate measures, right? In other words, and there's some polling to back this up, there's some pretty good social science just the last couple of years around this idea that for many white conservative evangelicals who are supportive of Trump, they would gladly embrace a sort of lurch toward authoritarianism if it meant preserving what they see as a Christian America, rather than lose in a liberal democratic fashion. For a lot of his supporters in that base, they're hearing it and saying, good, it's about time.
What does this all mean for the church?
The secular public used to have a very positive view of the church in America, and now they have a very negative view, and that creates a barrier to entry into the church for those of us who are trying to reach out to bring people in and try to tell them about the love of God, and it's become very difficult to do so.
The book is The Kingdom, the Power, and the Glory, American Evangelicals in an Age of Extremism. Its author is Tim Alberta. Tim, thanks again for coming in, and congratulations on this extraordinary book.
Thank you so much for having me.
Norman Lear, the groundbreaking TV producer and writer, has died at the age of 101. He revolutionized primetime television with a string of hits dominating the airwaves in the 70s and 80s, including All in the Family, The Jeffersons, Maude, and more. And he featured political and social issues of the day in a way not done before. Jeffrey Brown has a look back at his legacy for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
Those were the days. It was a show, a character, a voice, a style that changed television history.
I didn't have no million people out there marching and protesting to get me my job.
No, his uncle got it for him.
The 1970 sitcom All in the Family broke the norms of primetime TV by dealing with hot-button issues.
God, what God?
Through the divisions playing out in the home of the Bunker family.
What did you mean by what God?
We just don't see any evidence of God, that's all.
That's right, Daddy.
That's right, Daddy.
My God, that's me and my dad.
In a 2014 interview, Norman Lear told me the crass conservative Archie Bunker, played by Carol O'Connor, was inspired by his own father.
My dad called me a meathead dead from the neck up.
I am tuning you out, meathead.
And he used to yell at me that I was the laziest white kid he ever met.
Uh-huh.
And I would say, why would you put down a race of people to call me lazy?
Lear's shows addressed race, feminism, even in Maude, abortion.
There's only one sensible way out of this. You don't have to have the baby.
Well, what'll I do? Trade it in for a volleyball on Let's Make a Deal?
They stirred controversy at times and attracted enormous audiences, up to 50 million viewers a week.
The very first All in the Family.
And Lear fought for his vision. He told me how the network wanted to cut a line in the very first episode of All in the Family that hinted at his daughter Gloria and husband Michael, played by Sally Struthers and Rob Reiner,
you're early.
Having sex in the house as the parents returned from church.
11:10 of a Sunday morning.
But Lear didn't back down.
I saw very clearly in that instant that if that silly little, you know, if I lost that silly little battle, I would never win another one. Well, we're moving
on now. For 11 consecutive years, at least one of Lear's shows placed in primetime's top 10. In 1980, he founded the nonprofit People for the American Way to counter the rising influence of the Christian right in the moral majority movement. Lear received many honors and awards throughout his life, including two Peabodys, the National Medal of Arts, and in 2017, a Kennedy Center honor for lifetime artistic achievement. That same year, he offered a brief but spectacular take on the NewsHour, recalling how he dealt with having 8 shows at once on the air at the height of his career.
There is stress and there is joyful stress. The stress I was under was altogether joyful. It ended with 240 live people sitting in an audience laughing. Go beat that. It all added time to my life.
Norman Lear passed away in his sleep last night at his home in Los Angeles, surrounded by his family.
And joining us now is Rob Reiner, of course, one of the stars of All in the Family. He would go on to act in films such as Sleepless in Seattle and The Wolf of Wall Street, and gain further prominence as a director of such films as This is Spinal Tap and A Few Good Men. Rob Reiner, so good of you to join us. And first, our condolences at the loss of someone I know is very important to you. We talk now, looking back at how everything changed at a certain moment. You were there at that moment. Did it feel like everything was changing?
Well, no. We had a show that we thought was going to be canceled after, I don't know, after 3 episodes or something. I don't know. CBS put it on with a big disclaimer saying, "Nah, you can't watch this show. We don't want to have anything to do with it. You know, we don't even know how it got on the air. But if you want to watch it, watch it." We thought it would last a few episodes and then it would go away. And then, you know, over the time, it caught on and people started watching it. And it became the biggest show on television for a long time.
What did Norman Lear have that allowed him to do what he did, to mix real life into the sitcom format?
He had, can I say this on PBS? He had balls. This guy had a strength within him. I mean, you're talking about a man who flew 57 bombing missions over Nazi Germany during World War II. So the fights that he had with censors and with the executives, that was small potatoes. He had his convictions, he had his ideas, and he was going to present them. And he did it. He did it in a great way, and he got laughs at the same time. We had, you know, Mike and Archie fighting about every conceivable issue. Many of them are still relevant today, racism and guns and sexuality and all of that. But he did it with humor and with grace, and I'm going to miss him terribly. This has been a very hard day for me, and I got to say, to be honest, I'm glad I'm getting to talk to you and other people in the press, because it keeps me from crying, to be honest with you. You know, he was like a second father to me. You know, I was very lucky to have him and my dad, two great role models, and I got a lot from both of them. But from Norman, I got this idea that you could use your celebrity, you could use your fame, and you could do something good with it. And I took that to heart, and I've done things with my celebrity that I probably wouldn't have done it had I not had that path. And I got to say, it's so strange to me. You had a guest on right before, Tim Alberta, who yep. talks about, yeah.
No, I'm sorry, go ahead. We had Tim Alberta on.
Yeah. Well, he was talking about the separation of church and state and how we are seeing the rise of Christian nationalism. And I've just finished a documentary called God and Country, which is all about the rise of Christian nationalism. And that's the very thing that Norman Lear started when he started People for the American Way.
Yeah.
The idea was that this is America. This is the Constitution. It's in the Constitution three times. It's not, there's no argument about the separation of church and state. We fought so that we could have religious freedom in this country, or no religion at all.
You know, so I did want
to... It upsets me to know that we're moving in a direction away from what he wanted and what we all should be striving for.
Well, Rob Reiner, we only have about less than a minute. I did want to ask you about, this was of a piece, right? His life and his work, his politics, his social advocacy, but also entertaining people. Very briefly, how do you see his legacy?
His legacy will be, not only did he entertain people, but he got them talking. We were on television at a time when there was only 200 million people in the country, and there were 40, 45 million people having a shared experience. You couldn't tape it. You had to watch it when it was on. And so we put these issues out there, and we had people talking. Now, that discussion has gone away. We're all in these silos. We don't talk to each other. And we're seeing the rise of the very thing he fought his life for, is against fascism and to preserve democracy. And we see this fascism starting to creep back in. And this election, Norman would want me to be saying this, which is, if you want fascism, you vote for Trump. If you want democracy, you'll vote for Biden. It's that simple. And it's that real.
All right, combining all these things to the end for you. Rob Reiner on the life and legacy of Norman Lear. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Norman Lear was one of the giants. What a life.
What a life. Our thoughts are with his family and friends.
And as always, there's much more online, including a quick guide to who's on stage for tonight's fourth GOP debate in Alabama. That's at pbs.org/newshour.
And join us again here tomorrow night when we'll speak with former Congresswoman Liz Cheney. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. Thanks for spending part of your evening with us.